Welcome to the Hamilton Spectator Newsroom Insider. I'm David Crosby. I'm joined today by health reporter Joanna Frkatich to talk about the paucity of healthcare for the trans community in Hamilton. The city is taking action by writing a letter to the governmental body charged with overseeing the area's health administration. But first, I talked to Nicole O'Reilly about the progress of the homicide investigation into Angelo Musitano's death. Angelo was shot dead in the driveway of his Waterdown home on May 2, 2017. His wife and young children were home at the time. Angelo's father, Dominic, had been a major figure in organized crime in Hamilton until his death in 1995. Angelo and his brother, Pat, were accused with orchestrating the murder of rival Johnny Pops Papalia in 1997. They were charged with first-degree murder, but struck a deal and pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit murder in the death of Carmen Barilaro, Papalia's lieutenant. Angelo was released from prison in October 2006. Nicole, thank you for taking the time to sit down and talk to me about this. How do you characterize this piece that you've done? Is this a profile on Angelo Musitano? Is this just an update on the case?
I don't think it's really possible to do a profile on Angelo Musitano because his family is not talking. So that was sort of an intention, I think, that even the police feel like they don't fully know who Angelo Musitano was at the time of his death. So I see this piece more as sort of an update, taking a look 6 months down the road since his murder, sort of where police are.
Okay, and where are police?
They say that they still don't know who the shooter was. They still don't have a clear motive behind the crime. They're spending a lot of time looking through surveillance video still. We know that on the day of his murder on May 2nd, there was the Burgundy Ford Fusion that was seen driving down the road, pulling up, and then the shooter gets out of his car and executes Musitano in his driveway. We know that vehicle was seen sort of in the neighborhood in the week before, and police have been going through video basically of all Waterdown businesses to see if they could come up with any footage of this guy. It's unclear whether police have actually captured any more images of him, but they say regardless, they still don't know who he is and exactly what is behind the murder.
You'd spoken to Detective Sergeant Peter Tom.
Yes.
Peter Tom brings up this idea that it's kind of hard to know exactly how this might fit in with all the other sort of moving pieces right now in the Canadian mafia landscape, essentially. I'm curious, how did you get that response from him? What did you ask him?
So we know that there has been an increase in mafia, mob-related violence, particularly in Ontario, in the last 6 months since Angelo's murder. There have been some fires and activity in York region in particular. And I asked police, you know, whether they're looking at the connection between those incidents and Angelo's murder, and also the shooting that happened at Angelo's brother's Pat's house about a month after the murder. And they're certainly looking at the connection, and you know, what the police say is sort of from an outsider view, it's probably pretty clear that there is some sort of connection here. But again, without having key people on the inside talking to them, they don't know exactly what the issue is. And then there's also the question of, you know, is this connected to wider movement in the mafia, right? We know that there's some power play struggles that are happening with the mafia in Montreal, and sort of what is the connection there? And then we have the bust that happened last week, the big fentanyl bust, where you have the two Violi brothers who were from Hamilton, along with a number of other people who are charged. And again, so we're looking at the mafia being involved in fentanyl trafficking. So, you know, could there be a drug trafficking element here? All of this is possible, but police say that they just don't know for sure.
Which I imagine is fairly frustrating for them.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things to me was sort of you expect that police have all this sort of information at their fingertips. And, yeah. You know, it's even with the latest fentanyl bust, I had asked the homicide detective, Peter Tom, here in Hamilton, whether he knew if there was any connection to the Musitano case, and he didn't have the answer yet, because he said he didn't know anything other than what was being reported in the paper, because he hadn't sat down with investigators yet. So I think sometimes there's this expectation that police can just get access to everything, but they say that, you know, in this case, without Musitano's family talking to them, they don't really have a clear picture of what was going on in his life before the murder happened. And, you know, it was clearly a targeted hit, and that's impossible to ignore. And we know the history of his family, but, you know, what he was exactly into at the time is unclear. Was this retaliation for stuff that happened 20 years ago when Angelo went to prison, or was this something related, something that happened more recently, or was it both, or was it something we haven't even thought of? They just don't know.
Right, right. And that actually touches on another point I wanted to raise. You talk about just how difficult it is for them to have this investigation without sort of access to the family and without family talking to them. How normal is that, and how abnormal is it to have a defense lawyer of some of the caliber of Dean Paquette acting as family spokesperson?
It's highly unusual. Yeah. You know, most families of murder victims want to see that solved, and they talk to police. I can't think of other recent cases where this has happened.
Can you think of any non-recent cases where this has happened?
You know, I've been at the Spectator covering crime for going on 8 years, and this is the first sort of like mafia type case that I've written about. So there has been not a single case in my time here where this has happened and police categorized. You know, I think Peter Tom's called it strange.
You also interviewed somebody named Antonio Nicasso, who's an organized crime expert. I'm just personally curious how exactly one becomes an organized crime expert.
It's something he's written, like, I think he's written something like 30 books on the subject. He teaches a course on it at Queen's University. And he has sources sort of in that world that he speaks to and does a lot of research on it.
If we think that this is a revenge killing for something in Angelo Musitano's past, as opposed to something recent, what do we know about sort of his recent activities, his life after prison?
We know that he got out of prison in 2006. And from property records, you can see that he bought a house on Acadia Drive, which is out in the Stone Church Road, Upper Sherman Avenue area, in 2007. There was a property, or there was a business that was registered to that address, sort of seemed to be like a construction business, but whether that business was ever operating is unclear. We know that he got married in 2012. His wife's name, or that property on Acadia Drive, was transferred to his wife's name, and they later moved to that Waterdown address in 2014. There's a couple businesses associated with him that police say appeared to be legitimate. So we know that at the time of his death, he was a co-owner of a construction business in Hamilton that was described as sort of mid-level, that did concrete work. We know that he was not the owner on paper, but that he started, I guess, in a middle management position and rose up to being a co-owner. And there was also some restaurant businesses that he was involved with, a restaurant chain called Ole Gourmet, a Mexican eatery that started with a location on Lock Street that he was a co-owner of. Most of those locations appear to be closed now. There is an independently owned franchise still in Stony Creek, but again, police said that those businesses, by everything that they can see, are legitimate. There's no indication there was money laundering or anything going through them. We know that he became quite religious in recent years and was part of a Christian men's group. And people had said that, you know, he turned his life around and found God. And he had three very young sons who were also in the house along with his wife when he was murdered. So, you know, neighbors in his Waterdown and neighborhood had no idea sort of who he was and what his past was. But again, then you have the fact that he was murdered in what was clearly a targeted hit.
What do we know about how the mafia works when it comes to murder, a hit like this?
So, you know, and like, we can't guarantee that this is exactly what happened in this case, because obviously we don't know for sure why Angelo was killed. But generally, when it comes to the mob or mafia, a murder doesn't just happen on a whim or some because of a personal beef. It's something that is clear and calculated, and it's typically something where someone gets permission to take someone out by a boss or a superior or someone sort of higher in the organization. So it's very unlikely that a targeted hit would just sort of happen quickly or without thought of the repercussions. And what some sort of mafia insiders say is that the speculation is that regardless of the why Angelo was murdered, it's the why now is almost the more interesting question. And sort of the speculation is that whatever protections that the Mustajanos had back in 97 at the times of the Papalia murder was gone now. And that regardless of whether it's about something old or new, that the reason why the murder happened now is because someone allowed it to happen.
This potentially also having to do something with the power vacuum created by Right. Vito Rizzuto's death.
Right. So we know that when Vito Rizzuto was the Don, right, and he had a really centralized control of the Sicilian Mafia in Canada from Montreal. And when he died in 2013, that all went away. And what Mafia sort of watchers and experts say is that there is a struggle for, or the speculation at least, is that there is a struggle for control in that sort of power vacuum. And what's happening within that struggle for control is that related to the mob violence that we're seeing in Ontario, including here in Hamilton.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time, Nicole.
No problem.
So the city has flagged this issue and is sending a letter to the LIN, the Local Healthcare Integration Network, about access to healthcare for trans people in Hamilton. Tell me more about this.
So yeah, thanks for having me today, because I think this is such an important issue to talk about. So, there has been what one family doctor described as a massive hole in healthcare for transgender people in Hamilton. And it's such a serious problem that many people are seeking care in other cities. So they're going to Cambridge, they're going to St. Catharines to try and get care. And then where there is care here, there are very long waiting lists. For example, McMaster has one of the only McMaster Children's Hospital has one of the only two pediatric clinics for transgender care in Ontario. The other one is at SickKids in Toronto. And our clinic here in Hamilton has a two-year waiting list, which waiting lists are very concerning when you're talking about trans healthcare, because that is most likely when someone has made that decision, you know, as one advocate said to me, plucked up the courage to, you know, finally plucked up the courage to, you know, make this major transition in their life. And, you know, when they're sitting on that wait list, that is most likely when they are at risk of despair, most likely when they're at risk of suicide. So wait lists are a major concern. So when you have wait lists that are 2 years long, that is a major gap in our healthcare system.
Especially, I imagine, when a lot of those decisions are being made at a time in one's life, which is concurrent with adolescence in general, you know? I mean, that's generally, I think, for a lot of people, their first exposure to, and the hardest time for a lot of people in terms of mental health. So to have that issue compounded with a complete lack of resources is pretty terrifying.
Yes, it's really difficult. And actually, you know, one of the things that's driving this, you know, in some ways, there's a good news story in that people are coming forward earlier to, you know, in their life to transition, which it's overall, that's actually a really good story. But the bad side of that is that you have these waiting lists where McMaster is getting 2 to 3 referrals a week for its clinic. And, you know, it just can't keep up with that pace. And so that's for under 18-year-olds. But even for adults, you know, there is a twice monthly clinic that's run here in Hamilton. And that clinic, if you can believe it, is actually run by a Cambridge doctor. at the Cambridge, it's a Cambridge physician family doctor who comes to Hamilton because so many Hamilton patients were traveling to Cambridge to see this doctor. So she does this twice monthly clinic here, and she sees patients anywhere from the ages so far that have come to her between the ages of 14 and 62. So, you know, it's a big range there. And, you know, really what this letter to the Lynn is about is trying to bridge some of those gaps so that we don't need to have that biweekly clinic, because really most of these patients should be able to be cared for by their family doctor or by the clinic at McMaster once it clearly gets more resources. Mm-hmm. So, you know, really that is what this, why this letter is being sent to the Lynn is to ask the Lynn to, you know, help come up with some solutions to, you know, help make sure there are services in place both for these teens that, you know, clearly need to be, clearly need to get care far earlier than they're able to get it right now, especially because they're coming from all over the province, as you can imagine, when there's only two places, Toronto and Hamilton. And then also the adult story is more specifically about adults in Hamilton. That's more of a Hamilton patient story where, you know, they're having a lot of trouble finding family doctors who are either able or willing to provide that care.
And family doctors being willing is I suppose something that we should touch on. In your research thus far, in your exposure to this, how much is that something you've encountered? Doctors who simply aren't willing because of personal prejudice.
Well, you know, I talked to the doctor who runs the clinic in Hamilton, and, you know, she really is of two minds when it comes to this. Of course, that is out there. You know, there is some of that, unfortunately, some of that stigma and some of that bias, and some people are just transphobic, and that's, you know, that's a really unfortunate thing, and something that obviously needs to be dealt with. But actually, in a lot of ways, that's not really what drives a lot of the problem. You know, I don't want to belittle that part because, you know, the doctor does talk about how there is some very alarming stories that, you know, are just so sad to hear. But a lot of the problem isn't because, you know, the majority of family doctors are transphobic. A lot of the problem has to do with the fact that they don't get enough education, or maybe didn't get any education while they were in medical school. So they're very uncomfortable. They're very uncomfortable with this and don't really know what to do because they may only see, during their time in practice, they may only see one patient who is looking for this type of care. So, you know, transgender is somewhere between 0.5% and 2% of the population. So, you know, as a family doctor, it's not something that you're going to run across really frequently. So when you have a patient, a lot of the problem is that they don't know what to do. And that also, you know, family doctors are very overwhelmed right now. There are so many things that are being thrown at them, and it can be a lot of work to try and educate yourself on, you know, how to do hormone therapy or what type of help your trans patient needs. So, you know, I think there is a lot on that side as well, because I know the doctor that I talked to, it was very important to her that family doctors didn't get vilified, you know, as a blanket, saying that they're just unwilling to help, because she said, you know, she does want to acknowledge that it is a lot of work to try and learn how to do these protocols for one patient. Now, that said, it is possible to do, because there's so many resources out there actually for doctors to help them. If they have a trans patient and they've never dealt with that before, there is actually a ton of resources out there for them. There's resources on the internet that have protocols on how to do hormone therapy, other types of care that their patient might need. There is a weekly phone-in in Ontario where a family doctor can phone in, and they can have access to specialists in this area. Plus, the doctor who runs that twice-weekly clinic is willing to be available to help or mentor, because really that is the goal at the moment, is to make family doctors in Hamilton a lot more comfortable with doing this type of care so that they can so that they can provide this care for their patients. Because really, we'd rather not see a clinic where trans patients have to go to a clinic and be separated out from the regular healthcare system. That should not happen. Really, what should happen is it should be integrated with the healthcare system so that trans patients can go to their family doctor the same way you'd go to your family doctor for anything else and get the care you need. I think, you know, what is a big difference too is if you're a family doctor who you know, has a trans patient come to you, what we really don't want to see is, you know, there's a lot of stories of the family doctors being like, well, I can't really help you with that, good luck with that, which that is, you know, that's really not providing the right type of care. You know, if you're not willing to do it yourself, you have to or should be helping your patient find someone who can provide the care that they need. I had two trans activists actually tell me two very different stories, which I think, you know, really shows the difference of what can happen. So the one patient, you know, she was just not comfortable going to her family doctor. And that happens in a lot of cases. You know, a lot of trans patients are scared of going to their doctor, or they just don't feel that their doctor, for whatever reason, is going to handle that very well. And so this patient didn't go to the doctor, went years without a family doctor, which is obviously not ideal at all. And then finally was able to find a family doctor through other friends. Where the other advocate that I talked to, when he went to his family doctor, he actually printed out the protocols and brought the doctor a lot of education. And he had an excellent family doctor who had never done it before, but was willing to learn how to do it, you know, looked into that and got some of that knowledge herself. And, you know, he describes as the two of them sort of muddled through together. You know, they made some mistakes along the way, but they, you know, they worked through it together. And when that doctor actually left the practice, the new doctor who came in was also, had never done it before, but was also willing. Like, that is the type of care that is really good care. And that made a huge difference for that patient, both in, you know, having the courage to go and say that you're ready to transition and have that acceptance and help and support from your family doctor versus feeling like you can't even broach the topic with your family doctor. So, you know, I think that really shows why this is something that, you know, we really want to educate family doctors about and really help to get family doctors on side and get family doctors aware of, you know, what resources are out there to help them and how they can help their patients.
Is that how we tackle this then? Because as admirable as that is, not everyone is in the position or comfortable enough to be able to self-advocate for themselves in the way that that person did. In the instances of doctors, like you said, saying good luck with that sort of thing, what do we do? How do we fix that?
Well, one of the things that's being advocated for in this letter is that so there is a trans health coalition, and that coalition would really like to have what they would call like a coordinator. It would be a person who could you could go to as a trans patient, and that person would help you navigate the healthcare system. So depending on what type of services you need, you know, maybe that person would know family doctors who are more comfortable with it, or maybe that person would be able to help you help you navigate that with your own family doctor or get you other types of services that you need. You know, that I think, you know, we run into that problem all the time in the healthcare system, you know, no matter what healthcare you're talking about, is having somebody who knows the system and who knows where you can get the help. That makes such a difference. And so that is one of the things that's being advocated for. And that the thought is maybe that would help make a difference. And maybe it would also be a place where if there was this coordinator, maybe even family doctors themselves could go to this coordinator to either get the help to find out where they can get the knowledge themselves or where they could send their patient to get the care. And so, you know, I do think that could be that sounds like something that could help to be an important solution. And then plus, this coalition is also working on educating family doctors. They're working on trying to reach out to family doctors and, you know, trying to bridge that gap a bit with that community so that maybe more family doctors are willing to get on board and willing to help out trans patients. You know, it is Hamilton has always been somewhere that's very forward-thinking when it comes to medicine, and is somewhere that generally actually is very good at looking after marginalized communities. So it's a bit surprising that we have such a big gap. And I know there is a lot of optimism that Hamilton has the right climate in its healthcare community, that this is something that, you know, with the help of the LIN and, you know, with the help of things like the Academy of Medicine, maybe, that that there will be a way to help bring about some change and an improvement, because, you know, obviously this cannot stay with the status quo. And then in the case of McMaster, that is a bit of a different case, because that obviously that is a clinic that needs more. In the case of the adolescent clinic, obviously that's a clinic that needs more, simply just needs more resources. And so, you know, the LIN is one of the places that helps determine where provincial health spending for this community goes. And so I think the hope is that, you know, the LIN will be able to maybe look at some ways where that clinic could get some more resources in order to be able to see more patients.
For people who aren't necessarily as familiar with the trans community, what are some of the health problems and challenges the trans folk face?
Well, the main thing is getting hormone therapy. You know, that is sort of the big barrier that they face. That's the big barrier that a lot of family doctors don't have never encountered that before and don't know how to do it. And the fear is that you can get a lot of those hormones through other means, through black market means, and you really don't want that. You know, it's really important that there is that someone with medical training is overseeing the hormone therapy. You don't want people doing that on their own with hormones they're, I don't know, getting from the internet or their gym or who knows where, right? So it's really important that that they're able to get hormone therapy. And then there's, you know, other things. The clinic at McMaster offers help with families, you know, allows families to get some support, you know, through that transition as well. Things like speech therapy, things like social work, and things like that. And then there's also the issue that this community is a community that feels sometimes stigmatized or discriminated against when they go to emergency rooms, or, you know, when they go to see a doctor, or even if they haven't, they've heard enough stories about other people who have, that sometimes that can create, you know, a bit of a fear and make them hold back in seeking out care. And you don't want to see that. You know, you want to create a healthcare system where, you know, people in the trans community feel comfortable going to an emergency department if they need that care, or going to an urgent care clinic or their family doctor or a specialist. So, you know, it's some of it is about the therapy that they need. And then some of it is about just making sure that they feel comfortable approaching the healthcare system and asking for care.
Thank you so much, Joanna.
Oh, well, thanks so much for, you know, helping to bring awareness to a really important issue.